In 1965, activist Merle Thornton and her friend Rosalie Bognor walked into the public bar of Brisbane's Regatta Hotel and ordered a beer. The bartender refused to serve them under laws that segregated Australian pubs and forbade women to be served in public bars. In protest, the two women chained their ankles to the bar rail and refused to leave. And I think what Merle Thornton said in an interview years later about this gives an indication of just how much attitudes have changed since then. She said, "The staff were horrified and called the police. The people drinking in the bar were about evenly divided." There are other facts in Australian history that contribute to a picture of how far we've come. In the early 1960s, women couldn't get a bank loan in their own right or serve on juries. And publicly distributing information about contraception was illegal. Before 1966, women who worked in the Federal Public Service had to resign from their jobs when they got married. And before 1969, it was legal for an employer to pay one rate to men and a lower rate to women for the same job. And at this time, divorce was only available under the strictest of circumstances. So I think we can all agree that women's lives have changed dramatically for the better between then and now. The women's liberation movement, both mass protests and actions like Merle Thornton's, have won a series of important legal and social battles. In law, women have equal pay. We now have more control over our reproduction and over the direction of our lives than ever before. We can end a relationship freely if we choose to do so. These hard-won gains and all the changes in people's ideas and attitudes are the result of long decades of campaigning and protesting and organising. But unfortunately, it's not all progress. Despite these gains, sexism is still very real and it affects our lives every day. In recent years, women have actually lost some ground. I'll give some examples of this. In Australia, the gender wage gap is worse today than it was in 1985. Over the Howard years, the proportion of women in top corporate positions declined. And the National Foundation of Australian Women reports that government job-seeking assistance for women was actually better in the 1950s. And supposedly this was the decade when we were all just meant to be housewives. But whereas in the 1950s, married women could access the full range of employment services provided by the government, regardless of the employment status of their spouse, today these services are restricted, and women whose husbands work are no longer entitled to many of them. Along with these economic setbacks, there's an ideological crackdown against women and against the ideas of women's liberation. If you've been following the recent spate of attacks on abortion rights in the United States, you'll have some idea of what I mean by this. Take the story of Christine Taylor. Christine is a woman from Iowa who has two children. Her husband left her after she told him she was pregnant with their third child. In January this year, she fell down the stairs in her home. And at the emergency room, Christine confided in the nurse who treated her and said that she had considered having an abortion. Now, I don't know what any of you would do in that situation, but the nurse and the doctor at the hospital thought that the best idea was to call the police. And Christine was arrested under anti-abortion laws for attempted feticide. That's right, she was arrested for thinking about abortion and then having the nerve to fall down the stairs. She spent 2 days in jail for what essentially amounts to a thought crime. And the district attorney declined to prosecute Christine Taylor, not because this whole episode was a shocking breach of her human rights, her dignity, and any semblance of medical professionalism, but merely because it was found she was in her second trimester, whereas the relevant law would only have applied in her third. Thankfully, we're not at that stage in Australia and some other parts of the world. But if you look around, you still find some pretty severe anti-women sentiment. And these sentiments, I think, are completely mainstream. Bettina Arndt is an Australian columnist and author, and she argues in The Sex Diaries, her book, published by Melbourne University Press, that feminism went too far. And, thanks, that it did women a great disservice by teaching us that we have the right to say no to sex. She writes, "The right to say no has to give way to saying yes more often." In other words, she condones and excuses rape. And unfortunately, this attitude is not limited to right-wing journalists. A study in the UK earlier this year found that over half the respondents, men and women included, said that if a woman accepted drinks from a man, danced with him in a sexy way, or drank too much, or dressed provocatively, that she should accept responsibility for being raped. Someone who has been sexually assaulted is never responsible. The women's movement fought to make this a given, and yet in our generation it is not. I often encounter the argument that society just needs more time, that we'll eventually get equality, we just need to be patient. But the point is that until we deal with the root causes of women's oppression, some of the gains that we fought so hard for can be eroded. I think patience is the last thing we need. What we need is to work out what the root cause is of oppression and of sexism so we can get rid of them once and for all. And one of the reasons I think Marxist ideas are such a powerful tool for doing this is that they don't rely on simply looking at the surface, at ideas, at the media, and at attitudes and so on. What we try to do is to uncover the material reality that gives rise to these ideas and look at why the economic setup of a particular society would require oppressive ideologies to keep it together. So, in the context of sexism, in looking for its material base, the first thing we notice is that only societies that comprise a ruling class living off the labour of a producing class, that is, exploitation, only such societies have oppressed women, because only these societies need to restrict women's sexual freedoms. Friedrich Engels wrote The Origins of the Family, Private Property and the State, the first account of human history that was based on analysing how societies produce their living. Engels identified that in societies in which a ruling class owns and controls wealth, they also need to own and control women's reproductive power in order to restrict inheritance. Which is why Engels called the division of society into classes the world historic defeat of the female sex. Today, the source of gender oppression is the way our current class society, capitalism, exploits our labour power, both in the workforce and in the home. Capitalism, with its drive for profit, constantly needs to find ways to increase the rate of exploitation of the working class, to cut costs and to justify the status quo. And the oppression of women is a very important mechanism for doing this. Before I explain how this works, I want to say that to talk about women as a category or men as a category can be misleading, because all women do not have the same class interests. The lifestyles of working class women and men have a lot more in common with each other than either does with the lifestyles of the rich and powerful. Our experience of life is much more characterised by our social class, by whether we own a company or whether we have to work to earn a living, than it is by our gender. So there's nothing that unites us as women, because ruling class women, while they do suffer from sexism, also benefit from the way the system works, in that they profit from exploitation. Furthermore, their economic power provides them with a means to escape the worst aspects of gender oppression. To go back to Christine Taylor's horrible experience of being betrayed by the medical system and jailed as a result of that, this is a uniquely working class experience, the experience of someone without any wealth to throw around. A woman with the wealth and resources to pay for a discreet abortion and the best medical care would never have been treated like that. So to talk about the roots of women's oppression, we need to examine the material reality of the lives of working class women and men. Despite anti-discrimination laws, women in our society are not equal. They're economically worse off and disempowered in many ways. Firstly, the gender wage gap still exists. At the moment, women full-time workers earn about 18% less than male full-time workers. Secondly, the workforce is gender segregated, and this makes women worse off too. When you compare all workers, whether full-time, part-time or casual, the wage gap is even greater. Women earn on average 65% of what men do. Now, of course, this doesn't mean that if you go and get a job in a cafe that you'll earn 65% of what the men working there do. It's not actually how it works. What it means is that the way women take part in the workforce is unequal. Women are far more likely than men to work part-time or casual jobs. And they're concentrated in specific industries that have historically been feminised, that is, female-dominated, and hence paid lower, such as teaching, aged care, and childcare. As an indication, the top industry employing women is health and community services. The Australian Services Union this year launched a campaign highlighting the issue of devalued work in this industry and emphasising that it's because these jobs have traditionally been seen as women's work that they have not been respected and their wages have been held back. And I think this setup directly benefits the owners of capital and those who run the system in two major ways. Firstly, because they get cheap labour from these sections of the workforce. And secondly, because labour power is a commodity, there's a going rate for it on the market. If a section of workers gets paid less, it drives down the price of labour generally. And historically, capitalism has been using sexism to get cheap labour and to create this downward pressure on wages across the board for both women and male workers since the Industrial Revolution. As women workers entered the developing textile industry in Britain, for example, employers actually sought them out because they thought they would be more manageable and more docile. And because of sexism, they could get away with paying them less, which they enthusiastically did. And this was a huge part of the reason for the downward spiral of everybody's wages that drove the working class deeper into poverty. The inequalities in the way paid work is organised feed into another area of life in which women are oppressed, and that is the nuclear family. We know about the importance of family values in conservative and mainstream ideology. Politicians come out with this stuff every day, whether it's Kevin Rudd invoking traditional family imagery while supporting the ban on same-sex marriage, or whether it's Tony Abbott telling young women not to have sex before they're married, or the sexist commentary about the fact that Julia Gillard doesn't have any kids. Magazines and TV shows present heterosexuality as the default and most desirable way of living. Women are told constantly that we have to hurry up and find a man to procreate with before it's too late. And if someone dares to suggest that perhaps this could be different, perhaps we could be telling young children there are other options, that not everybody is heterosexual, you can pretty much guarantee they'll be held to pay. When the ABC screened a play school segment in 2004 that showed a kid going to the park with her parents who happened to be two lesbian women, this caused an absolute scandal. The Liberal government complained to the ABC board that the sky was falling and wouldn't someone please think of the children and so on. And when asked for comment, Wayne Swan, who was then the Labor Party's Family and Community Services spokesman, said, "I haven't seen the program, but I'd be concerned if a children's program explored issues of sexuality because that's a matter for parents." The implication of that being, of course, that all the other segments in play school about heterosexual parenting, they're fine. They're nothing to do with promoting a type of sexuality. It's just the way people are supposed to be. So the message is that failure to conform is scary and it will warp Australia's children for life. So I think this kind of ideology is well known to us. We experience these pressures every day. Most people resist it, in some ways, but it still affects all of us. And I think that what's less obvious, however, is why there's this constant barrage of sexism and homophobia, and why the state continually feels the need to involve itself in our sex lives and our reproductive choices. To understand this, we have to look at the economic role of the family and its importance in getting the working class to take individual responsibility for a whole range of needs that would otherwise have to be funded by capitalism. Things like childcare, domestic work such as cleaning, cooking and laundry, care of elderly relatives and care of the disabled. All these things sustain and rebuild the source of labour, the working class, from which all profit derives. This is work, it has to be done. The whole society needs children to be raised, to be socialised, but it's unpaid work. The Australian Bureau of Statistics estimates that the value of this work is the equivalent of just under 50% of GDP, gross domestic product. And this is hundreds of billions of dollars of savings. It's a massive freebie, and it comes disproportionately at the expense of working class women. The most recent Australian time use study from 2006 indicates that although the amount of domestic work that men do has been increasing, there are some fundamental inequalities in the way it's organised. Women still do twice as much housework as men do, and they still do three times as much childcare. And this doesn't mean that men are slobs who bum around the house and just expect women to pick up after them. Rather, it indicates that labour in our society is broadly divided by gender. Consider a situation where a man and a woman, a couple who might be completely committed to gender equality, have recently started a family. Because of the limited, expensive and poor quality childcare options available in Australia, they decide that one of them will stop work to take care of children. To make this decision, working class people must consider their financial options. And the most likely scenario is that he earns more than she does. So the most practical solution, no matter how anti-sexist they are, is for her to give up her job and for the man to keep working. Now imagine many, many such women and men making these kinds of choices every day. Consider the material circumstances they find themselves in. These millions and millions of individual choices on a mass scale add up to social trends and produce stereotypes. Like, women are caregivers, men are breadwinners. Women are passive, men are active. Women are better at emotional stuff and men are better at competitive stuff. And these stereotypes, I think, are so deeply ingrained that most of the time, unless we've consciously educated ourselves to be aware of these things and to understand them, we don't even know that we're making these kinds of assumptions. And I think this was shown very starkly in a recent article by Virginia Hausiger, published in The Age last week. Hausiger is best known for telling Australian women that feminism betrayed us by telling us we could have it all. And her argument is that we can't have it all. We must prioritise either having kids or having a career, not both. And her recent column was more of the same. But the flaw in the logic is, these arguments are never levelled at men. Men can breed all they like, and no one tells them that they can't have a career because of it. Because having kids simply doesn't affect men's lives in the same way. If a 30-year-old recently married man applies for a job, no employer will consider him potentially liable to quit if he has kids. On the contrary, having dependents, if it has any effect at all, will probably make him more determined to earn money, to commit himself to showing up every day, even if he gets sick of the job, because he's got a family to provide for. And on the other hand, discrimination against women because of their reproductive potential goes on every day. So what Marxism does is to identify the structural elements of class society that generate these sexist stereotypes and ideas. Sexism doesn't come out of nowhere. It's not part of human nature. Sexism arises because women's life options are systematically held back by the material conditions of our lives. At this point, I want to stress that this is not some kind of automatic process. It's very complex. I'm not simply saying that material reality controls our ideas and our behaviour the way a programmer controls a robot. That's not any kind of sensible explanation for the ways we think of ourselves and other people. What I am saying is that humans build their own self-concepts and construct their own identities and ways of relating to each other, but they do so in the context of a world that's set up in a specific material way. And to explore this further, I want to take the example of how children are socialised into gender roles in the context of the nuclear family. Studies show that parents overwhelmingly believe that they are neutral in the ways they treat their sons versus their daughters, that they believe they give them equal opportunities and encouragement. So they reject, in many ways, overt sexism when dealing with their kids. However, other studies that try to explore the ways in which adults, or that the gender stereotypes that adults have, influence their behaviour towards kids, present a more complex picture. The classic study in the 1970s by Condry and Condry showed two groups of adults a film of a toddler playing with a jack-in-the-box. One group were told that the child was a boy, and the other group were told it's a girl. And at one point in the film, the jack-in-the-box pops up and the kid reacts to this. Unfortunately, I don't have that to show you, but I'm sure it was very entertaining. The groups labelled the reaction differently depending on whether they thought the child was a boy or a girl. And the boy group said, he's angry. The girl group said, she's afraid. More recent studies confirm these kinds of gendered perceptions of children. For example, one study had 12-month-old babies crawling down a ramp, and before they got them to crawl, they asked the parents, how well do you think your child will do? Will she make it down the ramp? And the parents of boys were far more confident of their child's performance than the parents of girls. And yet, when they actually put the kid on the ramp and let him loose, or her loose, there was no difference at all in the way boys and girls performed in this task. Elizabeth Spelke, who's a professor of psychology at Harvard University, when discussing studies like these, puts it this way. As parents, we may be completely committed to treating our male and female children equally, but no sane parent will treat a fearful child the same way as they treat an angry child. So from the moment of birth, our interactions with adults around us shape different experiences for males and females. And I think an understanding of where these things come from, why our society needs to enforce beliefs about women being passive, being nurturers, and so on, really, understanding this really helps to interpret things like all the overt sexism we're exposed to every day. And how much time have I got?
Nearly at 25.
Okay, well, I'm going to skip that. I think identifying capitalism as the root of the problem means that some ways of organising are going to be useful to us and others are going to be less useful. We can't rely on getting more women into positions of power and wealth. This, I think, will do absolutely nothing to advance the cause of ordinary women. For example, Sue Morfitt is the CEO of Pacific Brands. And with a $1.8 million salary, Morfitt gets a real material benefit from the fact that women's jobs are undervalued, and because it means she can profit more from the labour of the mostly female workforce in the textile, clothing and footwear industry. Last year, when Morfitt made the decision to sack 1,850 workers across the country, the different experiences of Morfitt and her workers are very telling of the class antagonisms between women. A woman worker from the Coolaroo factory said of the sackings, "We're stunned by what has happened. We were called to the canteen and told that the plant would close, but before we were being told everything was okay. I'm a single mother with two children. It will be almost impossible for me to find another job in the Cessnock area." Another woman said, I've still got 2 children at school and 2 who have finished. We have a mortgage to pay, all up $2,000 a month. Where are we going to get the money? I'm only earning $30,000 and my husband $45,000. We're struggling as it is. And meanwhile, the worst thing that happened to Sue Morfitt was that she had to hire 24-hour security at her Hawthorne mansion to stop disgruntled workers from trashing her tennis court. And conversely, working class men get no benefit from this setup. As I said, the unfair treatment of one section of workers has negative consequences for the working class as a whole. And while women come off much worse in terms of gender roles and how they're constructed, there's nothing beneficial in the fact that, for instance, young men in high school continually have to establish and re-establish their masculine credentials and are liable to physical and verbal abuse and violence if their efforts are deemed inadequate. I think identifying these different class interests tells us something immensely positive, that it's in the best interests of the working class as a whole to fight for women's liberation. At the end of the day, if we want to challenge the root of women's oppression, we have to challenge capitalism. Marx and Engels did not develop an analysis of women's oppression just for the purposes of lamenting about how terrible it is. They did so because they believed, as I do, that the subordinate position of women in society is part of the foundations of class exploitation, and that the liberation of the whole working class depends on understanding sexism, understanding how it props up capitalism, how these ideas are used against us, and in consciously rejecting them. A major theme of this weekend has been posing a strategy for the kind of fight back we're going to need to deal with all kinds of oppression. And I think the first step in that strategy should be to start to build an organisation that sees fighting for women's liberation as a central question, not as a tacked-on concept that's only relevant to half the population, but as something that is integral to our whole worldview. And that's the kind of organisation that we're trying to build.